Hello and welcome to Angels Costumes Behind the Seams. I'm Jeremy Angel.
I'm Jonathan Littman.
And I'm Richard Green.
Today we're happy to release my interview with Anne Masgray. Anne is a costume designer and she has also got a making background as well. She's also been an assistant designer and she's been working in the industry for quite some time. And she still makes to this day. I know she works on other jobs as well for other designers making as well as designing for herself. But it was a conversation I really enjoyed. I always like talking to Anne. I just like where she comes from. She just says it as it is, and it's always fantastic to have someone who's very open and honest about things.
I think her industriousness over the years has really paid off in the respect that everything that she's learned, not just in terms of the skill of manufacturing and creating and understanding how a workroom is put together and the problems therein, but also the whole concept and psychological aspect of designing from her years as an assistant to, you know, some pretty high-flying creative minds,
yeah.
Jim Acheson being one of them.
Yeah.
And I think that all of that, pros and the cons of working for such skilled artists, has put her in the situation that she's in now, which is great. And it made the chat very interesting, hearing all of those details.
Yeah, she assisted for Jim Acheson on Wind in the Willows. She also worked with him on Dage Liaisons. Jim or James, I know he's mentioned on the podcast a few times. Jim is quite a big designer and was in the day. I mean, he's a 3-time Oscar winning designer for shows he's done, and it must have been incredible working with him. I only knew him sort of from football when Dad might invite him to the odd football game or anything. But what was he like to work for?
I seem to remember him teaching you magic tricks.
He introduced me to BBC comedy.
Yeah, Jim Acheson. I'm going to call him Jim. Is an incredible guy, and I'm very, very fond of him. He now lives in New Zealand, but for a long time back in the 80s, he and Angels did a lot of work together. We did a production called Bullshot Crummond, as opposed to Bulldog Drummond, which was a spoof on Bulldog Drummond. Mm. And we also did Last Emperor. I did Biggles with him, which I thoroughly enjoyed. He's a very, very, very talented man, quite driven. You certainly don't want to get on the wrong side of him. I remember him tearing a strip off your father and I in the in the tailoring department. I know we were like two little schoolboys. There was something wrong with some of the suits that we were making for Sheltering Sky, and he basically took us to the tailoring department and showed us in great detail what was wrong with them. And we just basically, the pair of us, stood there shuffling our feet and looking kind of guilty about it.
Wow.
But he's a great guy. He's got a fantastic sense of humour. And as I say, he puts his heart and soul into whatever he does.
It must have been great to work for someone like that.
Phenomenal. Absolutely. Yep.
I enjoyed working on Singapore Grip with Anne because my grandfather used to say an amateur should never take on a professional. And when we were talking about the making side, at that point of time, there was nothing I knew that I could say about the making side of that show that Anne didn't know more than I or know better than I. So it was more of a case of she knew what she wanted from a making point. There was no need to argue with it because she knew exactly how it was meant to look and how it should go and the effort and time that should be put in, which, again, for me, it was great to experience that working with her.
Yes, yeah. She certainly knows what she wants and how she wants to achieve it. We actually did some interesting makes and things on that production, on the uniforms, because they were filming this out in Thailand, where, of course, things are relatively cheap to make. So what we did was we made some of the uniforms here, and then we sent out the same fabric and I think some patterns out to Thailand so that they could get bulk of those made over there, which worked very, very well for us because we had control over the fabric and the style, so we knew that there weren't going to be any nasty surprises in terms of that. But they got a better deal. I mean, I know you did a good deal on the show anyway, but they got those things and we got to keep them all when they came back. So it was kind of win-win. Gave us a whole load of summer weight Japanese uniforms. We already had winter weight ones from Empire of the Sun, where we did the Japanese going into Shanghai in 1936. So it worked very well. And, you know, they got what they wanted at a good price and we got costumes back. So it's kind of re-energized our Far Eastern Second World War uniform stock.
And it was great that they were willing to do that and again take advantage of what we could offer, or even if it wasn't making side, it was using the equipment and then providing us with hypothetically a shirt at the end of it. It gives us, it's a great way of sort of not making a compromise, but allowing both parties to get something they need.
Yeah,
and
it's kind of win-win, because, you know, the difficult part about about one of those uniforms isn't really the shirt and the breeches. You know, they're khaki cotton. If you've got the right samples, you can make them. But the tricky bit is getting the webbing equipment and the helmets and the badges and, you know, the right gaiters and the right boots and things. So it worked very well as a combination. I was very pleased with that.
No, it was a fun show to work on.
I was particularly struck by the comment when she went to New Zealand to work on The Hobbit about the people who worked on Lord of the Rings cycle who thought that they were going to do the same kind of thing until she put them straight pretty firmly, I thought.
It's also, her story is actually a very interesting one in the sense of she wasn't taken on that job to be a designer. So it's always just being prepared for what might come, and her experience put her in a position that she was able to be offered that job as well once she was there, and she could deal with it. So it's a case of good at what you do, and you have the good reputation, and you're in the right place at the right time. It does pay dividends.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We hope you've been enjoying these conversations. We've been enjoying your feedback. If you have any questions or requests, please email them to podcast@angels.co.uk, or you can visit our website, which is www.angelsbehindtheseams.com, or you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We are /costume podcast. And here's my chat with Anne Masgray. Today I'm joined by Anne Masgray. Anne is a designer, and she's got quite a long history in doing many different roles. She started out, and again, I'll probably be correct on this, she started out on the making side of things, and she worked her way through there and then moved up to running workrooms and then also becoming a designer. She is the first person we've actually spoken to that has a making background, as that was what they came in into costume for. So first and foremost, Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Jeremy. Nice to speak to you, and I'm glad to be taking part in this.
Well, it's lovely to be speaking to you, and I hope we don't annoy you too much with these questions. And the format we've tried to keep to is we've got five core questions that we're asking everyone that we speak to, just to get their views on the industry, training in the industry, working in the industry, and also their history. And it's been an amazing experience to hear all the different answers and the different routes in people have. So if it's okay with you, I'd love to start with the nice, simple, easy question of, where did it begin? How did you become the designer you are today? Where did your journey into costume, or getting into costume, begin?
I sort of, as a child, just loved theatre, basically, and made my own little ballet costumes and cut out dolls and stuff, and was taken to the theatre a lot as a child. So that was in my background. And then ultimately, when I got to the, you know, ghastly age of 18 and you have to decide what to do, I was sort of rescued by my art teacher, who suggested that I went and did a theatre design course, and I didn't know about it. My parents certainly didn't. Nobody in my family had a background of any of that. And my eyes sort of lit up, really, because it just seemed like a combination of everything that I liked. And so I did end up at Wimbledon Art School for 3 years. Didn't do an art foundation, just went straight in there and had the delight of learning props and dyeing and all the associated crafts that go towards designing, technical drawing and such like. And from there, I ended up getting a job at the Crucible Theatre as a dresser. It wasn't like, you know, the pinnacle of what I wanted to do, but I had to go home initially because, rather unfortunately, my father died just as I was doing my finals. So I went back home to Sheffield, worked in Marks and Spencer's in ladies' skirts.
In clothing, at least.
Yes, it was clothing. It wasn't the sort of clothing I liked particularly, but it was a job. I just needed a job. My mum and I needed to be working. And so I did that for, I can't remember how many months, but then it was like 5 minutes walk to the local theatre, the Crucible. And so I sort of basically knocked on the door and went, got any jobs? And they said, yes, we need dressers for this new musical we're doing. So I had a very busy time of working 9 to 5 at Marks and Spencer's, running down the road, grabbing a sandwich, and then working till 10:30 at night as a dresser on a very busy show called Chicago, which a lot of people might know. and loved every minute of it. And so I kind of had my foot firmly in the door then. And that's where I ended up next, really, in the costume department full time and dropped Marks and Spencer's.
When did the making come into it? When did you get into the making? Because I didn't know before all of this, I didn't know you'd been a dresser. I knew your background was making, and that was what I, before you were designing, I knew you were a maker. So when did the making come in?
Well, I guess it just sort of happened, really, because, well, basically, I had a job as a dresser. You know, having done the design course at Wimbledon, it wasn't like what I was aiming for, as I said. But then they asked me to do a big floor cloth. They asked me to make a huge floor cloth after I did a dressing job, and basically left me alone to do it. And then when I'd finished, I went kind of, well, I've finished now. Does anyone want to see if I've done it properly? And on the strength of that, they said, oh, can you just come and work for us? And they gave me a 3-month contract. And then I went into the costume department and realised how much I didn't know. And what the cutter there, kind of, you know, just sort of practically cutting without patterns and putting things together on a Bernina sewing machine. And I just thought, well, I think I'd like to have a go at that. And so I just, every time there was an opportunity to learn how to make something, I was in there putting my hand up. And we did a show which required a lot of dyeing, and I had done a lot of that at art school with Mathilde Sandberg. And so I knew quite a lot of that and enjoyed it. So I'd put my hand up and do, well, I'll do the dyeing. And so it kind of went like that. It was a great playground stroke learning curve, because I could have a go at everything and everyone just let me. It took me ages to figure out how to cut a pair of sleeves to fit an armhole. That was a bit of a trial. But it just kind of went on from that, because the Crucible was a sort of autumn through to spring season. And then I was like, well, I don't want to go on the Dole. I don't want to go back to Marks and Spencer's. And then I realised I could apply to Glyndebourne Opera and do a summer season there. So I went there in the costume department as a maker. And then, well, actually, I was an assistant cutter. So I just thought I'd be helping the cutter, which I was. And then one day they gave me the Countess's frock from The Marriage of Figaro and went, well, we need another version of this, because it was for Felicity Lott and she's quite tall. And so they got out like 8 other versions of this frock from all the previous seasons, and I had to make a brand new one with those as a reference thing. I can remember being severely traumatized by trying to get the pleats on the end of a pannier, but thinking, like, going away to the toilet to think clearly and going, well, I want to do this. I want to be able to do this. So I've just got to find a way of doing it. And so then I got kind of fascinated by cutting and pattern making. So I kind of stayed with it because it just became something that I really enjoyed.
It's interesting because you keep saying it's when you were 18, you didn't know where you didn't know the direction to go, and then sort of you found that the theatre, you were pointed towards the theatre design course. When that finished, you found the Crucible, and after that you found it yourself. You didn't know exactly the direction you wanted to go, and no one sort of pointed you, but you experienced a lot of things to find the direction you went into, which is one of the things we sort of keep hearing with a lot of people, is they don't seem to be, they like to try everything. They try everything before they've actually figured out what they want. No one's gone into this that we've spoken to yet that said, I want to be a costume designer because that means X. It seems everyone wants to work in costume, but they're then finding their feet and finding where their comfort zone is, which is amazing, because that's the thing we also realize, is people don't know just how many roles there are within costume, and to experience all the different ways and different approaches.
Well, there are a huge number of different roles. I mean, I think unfortunately now, you know, young people just go, I want to be a costume. They do go, I want to be a costume designer, and don't have a clue about what it involves. As a part of the reason I wanted to do this podcast was because you can clarify the number of things that are available for people to do within our industry, and they are huge. You know, I did enjoy dyeing a lot. I could have easily have gone down the route of being a textile artist quite happily, because I adored Mathilde. She was fascinating as a person. And what she did was just make pieces of art out of fabric or make a dull costume come alive. So I kind of followed that with avid interest, really. and kept in touch with her for a long time. Didn't ever actually do it professionally, but I had a good old smattering of it, and it's always an area that I like. I'm interested in printing and patterns and working out all of that. It's all been invaluable experience as I've come to do bigger projects myself. So, yeah.
And how did you go from there, from doing the cutting there and start cutting on TV and film and heading towards that side of the industry rather than staying in?
What happened really was the Crucible became too small in the end. And I can't remember exactly what happened, but I just thought, well, I've done this now. And I ended up running the department, and I'd done seasons at Glyndebourne. And it's like, unless someone dropped dead or moved on somewhere else, you had no way of moving on up. And I wasn't about to commit murder. So I thought, well, the best thing to do is try and go freelance. So that was a kind of step into an unknown territory. So I stepped out of the comfort zone of a weekly paycheck and went freelance as a maker, and just slowly built that up to doing quite a few things for the BBC. Word got around. And then a lady that I'd worked with at Glyndebourne, who was an assistant cutter at the same time as I was, Annie Headley, she'd gone freelance, and she asked me to come and work in her workroom on Dangerous Liaisons.
Okay.
So I kind of, although we lived miles apart, I did go and do that, and I did end up cutting things for that movie, which was beautiful. And as a result of that, I'm cutting a lot out here just because it goes on too long. As a result of that, I got to know James Acheson, and much later on, after I'd done quite a lot of freelance work, James Acheson asked me to make some things for the film Restoration, which is probably one of the most enjoyable experiences I've ever had on a film set. Mm. So he did that, and the more I made and came and fitted, the more they kind of absorbed me into the department. And again, cutting a big chunk out. The next movie he did was Wind in the Willows, and he asked me to be his assistant costume designer on that. So it kind of went a lot of making, more making, more making, got dragged onto a film set, then became an assistant costume designer, and kind of flitted between that and running workrooms for a bit.
And did you always work with the same designers the whole time? I mean, I know you said you were with James and work with him. Were there designers that you would always work with, or was it a case of any job would come, you would take it at that point with the cutting and the making side?
I think there was a variety of people at the BBC to begin with, when the BBC still had in-house designers. And then, you know, early on there was just all kinds of people from, you know, like repertory theatre people and people on commercials. And so, no, a good old smattering of different people. And then once you've got a relationship with somebody that works, I have worked with Jim a few times, so.
Yeah, and Jim from BBC and started Brazil. He did The Last Emperor, Dangerous Liaisons. And that was before Wind in the Willows. And so, working as an assistant designer, was that how different an experience was that for you, being an assistant designer?
No, I loved it actually, because I learned a lot from it. Because I initially, like when I did Wind in the Willows, I mean, I don't think I'd even seen a schedule before. I didn't know what it looked like, gobbledygook. When I first saw one of those, I was like, what's all this mean? I had to do a quick sort of, you know, short course of learning what it all meant, because no one told me. I mean, now when I have trainees in, I kind of sit them down with the schedule and go, do you know what this means? Because it's really important that you can read a call sheet and you know the schedule.
Mm.
But I didn't. I didn't have any of that. It was real like fly by the seat of your pants. So I got that a little bit from Restoration because I was kind of on the sidelines of it, but saw it. And then Wind in the Willows was more scary. It wasn't a big film, but you know, I had to learn all those things about, you know, getting everything ready by a certain time, making sure it was on the truck. It wasn't as creative as what I had been doing, but it was just good. I think the thing is, I like a challenge, so it was another challenge and another kind of string to my bow. And I wasn't still particularly aiming to be a costume designer at that point. It was just really interesting to be assisting someone else and learning how they worked and how everything knitted together as a production. But to be perfectly honest, I couldn't really go back after that point.
When you were cutting in on these productions, you did quite a lot of different, obviously, periods and worked with a lot of different designers who have different approaches and styles as well. I mean, you were cutter on The Fifth Element, if I'm correct.
Yeah, not that.
So you're working with Gautier. So was with working with
with, because he designed that film, and was it different working with a fashion designer versus working with the experience you'd had before with Jim on Wind of the Willows on restoration? Was the fashion designer's approach to it any different for you, or is it exactly the same? He's asking me to cut a jacket, as it were. Okay, it's futuristic, but or was the approach that a fashion designer brought completely different for you than a film designer?
In all honesty, it didn't feel like a different approach, because it's still someone drawing their vision in front of you and handing you something to go on. The thing about, well, that's when he was there, because he was running I loved him actually, but he was running a fashion business, so he couldn't be there like other designers are all the time.
Mm.
But when he was there, he'd draw in front of you and excite you and get you going on something new. But the main thing about Fifth Element was the fact that I had to deal with completely different fabrics and techniques that I had to do on, say, period films.
I mean, the fabrics are crazy. I mean, we've got some of the pieces from Fifth Element, which were just some of the background characters, so sort of like the medical outfits, which are, it's not quite latex, but it's practically latex material. And then there's other ones, then that's just the pieces on the Fifth Element were just so vast and varied with all the different fabrics and styles, because it was so futuristic, I suppose.
I don't know you have those. Are they kind of minty green one, lab coats?
Yeah, we've got those. We've got the green lab coats, and we've got those. We've got the shorter jackets, and there's a few pieces we have from the Diva Opera contingent. We've got those pieces, like the body armor and the veils and things like that. They're not your normal. Nothing on Fifth Element looks like anything you'll see on anything else, except then and now, I suppose. I mean, the Fifth Element's pieces were just so unique and different from everything we had.
Well, that's why it was so... I mean, I think it stands the test of time, Frank. I still think it looks extraordinary and is a very watchable film. For me, it was great to work on, again, because it was challenging. So I had to make Gary Oldman's rubber coat, and I'd never worked with rubber before. So that was like learning which glue to use and how to cut it. And how, you can't make a mistake with a rubber coat. You can't like go in a fitting and pin a bit out.
Hmm.
So it was tricky, but it was, again, very interesting.
Do you like that experience? Because you said before with Wind in the Willows, it was sort of flying by the seat of your pants sort of point. And I suppose when you're cutting those new fabrics and stuff, again, it's a whole new learning experience for you. Is that an odd but an odd enjoyment that you also get when you're suddenly challenged like that, that you're out, you're not out the depth of the wrong phrase, when you're working with something or doing something you've not done before, that challenge is something you like to rise to?
Absolutely. I don't think I've ever felt out of my depth. I felt a little nervous, like when I had to run to the toilet at Glyndebourne before I cut an inventory clock. But I felt a little nervous, like trying to stick a rubber coat together for Gary Oldman. But I don't shy away from it. I'd rather have a new challenge, because then you can go, oh, well, now I've done that, that means I can do that, that and that. So it's kind of forward-looking, I suppose.
You've done some other things, similarity to with Fifth Element. I mean, you were on Star Wars, the first new episodes that were filmed. You did Batman Begins and things. So it's sort of after Fifth Element, it was like you it not only did that, but you obviously... that was something you got very good at, and on other projects as well that were sort of similar challenging fabrics and things. It was something that you were good at and obviously known for, which is why you were on those, I'm assuming.
I guess so. I mean, like Batman was a whole new thing to learn, really. I mean, the whole, we called it Cape Town. We had this whole shop at the back of Shepperton, because there was no space in the main studio area to houses, so we kind of set up camp with all these porter cabins behind Shepperton. And you know, like my room was like me and four other people, I think, doing just the fabric side of Batman. But yeah, you had to learn what the mold makers were doing and what the art finishers were doing and what the sculptors were doing, and it was a kind of all-encompassing thing. And just really interesting, actually, but not really interesting when you've got to make 45 capes for Batman of varying lengths. Like the driving cape was only sort of like hip length, because no one saw the bottom of it, and you would never get that in a car.
Mm.
You know, and there was the iconic cape and the running cape and the fire cape. But nonetheless, to me, it meant 45 capes, really. All covered in flocking, which was the result. So, oh God, this is a nightmare. So Christopher Nolan wanted a cape that looked like velvet, but he didn't want seams. He didn't want it to have seams. So I remember having to describe to him why fabric only came in certain lengths and you'd have to have seams somewhere. Then I can't remember who came up with it, whether it's Graham Churchill or Lindy or everybody together. I have no idea. But someone had the idea that those things that you display jewellery on is covered in black flocking, and that maybe you could flock fabric. And so the fabric we used then was flocked ripstop fabric. And lengths were done in this place in Watford, and then they came to us and then they were washed. But even after all of that, whenever you started using it, there was a sort of film of black, tiny fluff everywhere. So at the end of the day, the whole of your cutting table, the whole of the floor was just covered in a sort of film of black. And when you blew your nose, it was black. And you had like black sleep in the corner of your eyes for forever, it seemed.
Could you still enjoy watching the film afterwards, after that experience? Did you still get to enjoy watching it?
You just take it on board, really. It's just like, well, this is how it is, you know. It's just
a lot of black, a lot of black fluff.
A lot of black, a lot of pulling two people, either two of them. I remember Dave Murch and I being either side of Christian, going like, look, we'll just hold this and you just have to let all your weight drop into these trousers and we'll pull them up. There's a lot of that, a lot of fun.
We've not even touched on yet about when you started designing, but it shows just from the small pieces you've told us now how important the team is, that when you're working on it, that everyone's involved, everyone's got to work together to find the solution. And it's how important is the dynamic of the team on when you're cutting? Is it something, when you're brought onto something like that, does that team and that philosophy, is it just as important then? You're not working on your own, you're not an island. How important is that?
You're not an island. I mean, like, and as a cutter, the key part of helping a designer realise their vision. I've worked with a lot of designers that just throw fabric at me and say, could you make something lovely out of that?
Useful.
Which is not what I call designing. You know, I've had designers come up to me and go, oh, I'd quite like something that's a bit halter-neck with a sticky-out skirt. Right, what would you like it in? Maybe this. No drawing again. And then on the other hand, I've had beautiful drawings, like Jim Acheson does beautiful drawings, and you really know what you're aiming at. But nonetheless, when you come to a fitting with either of those two extremes, it's still a dialogue that you have when you're in a fitting about where a line should be on a neckline or how a sleeve should fit or whether the character's got to be bold or timid or whatever they're representing, and that cutter frequently enhances the designer's work, or in some cases does it without the designer, which was the point at which I got very frustrated because I thought, I'm actually doing your job, really. On occasion, I have to say, not all the time. But it's nicest when you've got a collaborative thing going, and you know the designer and the cutter and the makers all know what you're aiming at, and you can all chip in and add pieces and suggest things. I thought when I started designing, I'd find it really difficult to get a cutter that I'd be satisfied with and not a horrible bitch to. I'm not a horrible bitch.
Never.
I did think whoever's going to end up being my cutter is going to have a really tough time because I can cut most things, really.
Just touching on what you were just saying there with working with the designers and everything, how important for the cutter and for you when you were cutting was the drawing?
Well, I think it's hugely important. I mean, you can call me old-fashioned here, but I seem to be one of the few people that still does drawings. I like drawing.
I don't disagree. I know that's true. I've walked in on your office when you were working on a production and you were sitting at your desk drawing, and I know not all the designers we work with do draw anymore, and it's one of the questions that does come up and we are speaking to people about. So I don't think it's old fashioned at all. I think other people are talking about the benefits and how much it starts with the drawing. The drawing isn't the end goal, but it starts and it sets the tone of everything for the people who are working.
I mean, I say call me old-fashioned because to me that's like, well, sorry, how can anybody work to something that's just a half a sentence and they've been thrown a piece of fabric? How can you know what that is? And in any case, as a designer, I get a project in my head. After I've read it, I start seeing things in my head and I think, oh, that might be nice that way around. Then I have to draw it for my own benefit. I have to put down on paper what my thoughts are. Initially, they often start off like little Giacometti scribbles. I'm not comparing myself to Giacometti, but they just sort of look like little wiry figures. And then I'll draw it properly and I might just throw it away and I might throw another one away. But then I'll go, oh, yeah, that's kind of better. I've got nearer the mark now. Mm. And then, you know, at least you've then got something to have a dialogue with somebody about what you want it to look like. And most producers and writers and directors want to see what you're aiming at, obviously. I have had a horrible situation where I was given fabric in a half sentence and then the designer got the concept artist to photograph what I'd made and then do a drawing from that photograph and then take it to the directors and show them what she'd designed, which is completely arsehead. Mentioning no names.
No, we don't do that. So, okay, then when did you start designing? At which point did that conversation come, and was it something that you wanted to do after you started assisting quite quickly, or again was that still something that you weren't looking at doing, still you were concentrating on the cutting and being the assistant designer?
I think when I was being an assistant designer on films, I felt that I was still learning and that I wasn't at the point where I should design necessarily, and then I had a child, and so I couldn't be an assistant designer on a film set because you just physically can't be there with a small child. So I went back to making. So it was kind of like my decision was taken out of my head anyway by a small person because it just the practicality. Mm. So as she grew up, I then had my own freelance workroom because that was manageable with a small person. And then I got asked to go and manage the workroom for Lindy Hemming on Clash of the Titans. And my daughter was of an age then when I could do that. So Lindy I've worked with a few times and each time it's been pleasant. So then I can't remember what happened after. Oh, yes, I can. I went straight on to another film, which I found deeply frustrating because the designer wasn't someone that I particularly respected. And during that time, I got asked to go over to New Zealand to work on The Hobbit, not as designer, but as a person running the workroom again. And at that point in our lives, we were a little bit fed up of things not going quite how we wanted, and we thought about emigrating and all the rest of it. So that's why I ended up going to New Zealand, because as a family, we all went, oh, what the hell, let's try it. And then I ended up designing it because of a set of circumstances that were somewhat extraordinary and still amaze me. And but I had designed other films that kind of just flipped back and forth. So I've kind of assisted design, then gone back to making, then went up to running a whole workroom, then designed a bit. I designed a film called Thunderpants, designed a film called Mumbo Jumbo. I can't remember in what order off the top of my head. But it kind of flipped back and forth. And then suddenly I was handed The Hobbit like on a plate, which is like, you know, a complete gift horse, really. But then when I came back to the UK, I couldn't get an agent, which mystified me. And it took a while to try and establish myself, and I still feel I'm trying to do that as a designer even after all this time.
On The Hobbit, how was going into that world with Peter Jackson and Tolkien's world of The Hobbit? As I'm sure that must have been just an incredible opportunity. Obviously it was an incredible opportunity, but that must have been an incredible experience, just because it's such a beautiful world that was created beforehand in film with the Lord of the Rings, but the books itself, the detail and the characters and everything, that must have just been a fantastic experience.
It was a fantastic experience. It was a very hard experience too, because I mean, talk about being thrown in at the deep end with no prep. And like now, if I think back to that, it was just like really flying by the seat of your pants, because Peter had picked up the reins of directing it and then fell ill and had to have an operation, which thankfully for me, put filming back a month. But I was literally like drawing every weekend to try and get ahead. And I don't think I had 3 months prep even, which is on something that scale is terrifying. And plus, you know, they all had very fixed ideas about what they wanted. And some of it, I would say, we clashed on, really. But you have to find a way to please directors and producers. I mean, there's things I'd like to have done differently, but there always is. Some of it worked really well, some less so. Kiwis are very industrious. I think sometimes a little set in their ways, or they were. You know, it was quite hard at first, particularly because people were just making things that they'd made for Lord of the Rings. And then they were going, oh, well, we did this last time. And I go, yeah, but we're not doing what you did last time. We're doing a new film called The Hobbit. I don't particularly want those mop caps, or, you know, it was hard like that.
Did you get you roll your sleeves up and get dirty with the cutting and hands dirty with the cutting and the making side of things with The Hobbit as well?
No, I did, because I can't help myself, really. You sort of get in there. I can't stop it, you know, like, and a lot of the time, like, I know I do drawing, but sometimes I will get inspired first by a piece of fabric rather than the sitting with a blank piece of paper and a pencil, and so frequently would design on the stand, as it were, like draped fabrics on the stand, put fabrics together on the stand, and I still do that because it's like, well, that doesn't quite work with that. I need something else to go there. So a lot of those dwarf costumes were put together just by me gathering textures and colours that I like together, and then going, right, the missing thing is this, and we'll have to print something for that.
I was going to say, the character I love, I'm going to butcher the name, and my wife is going to give me such a go at when I do this, because she loves The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. I can't actually watch those films with her because she knows every word in the films, because it was the book she loved growing up. And she like knew the books inside out. So yeah, she won't watch Good Morning Vietnam with me, and I won't watch Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit with her. So it's fine. Sylvester McCoy's character Radagast, I loved that character. I probably pronounced it wrong. I apologise. I thought that look was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a nice one to do actually, and that was sort of born about by putting a load of fabrics together. But it was a sort of unusual process in New Zealand, where you used to have to do drawings and send them in a night pack every evening. And I'd sort of done about 8 different Radagast and it wasn't really working. And it only really kind of gelled when I put all the fabrics on the stand and left it by the fitting room door. And then when they visited, the producers and director, then they could kind of see it as a thing. I mean, sometimes people read drawings differently, and sometimes people can't read drawings at all because they can't visualize it as a finished thing. So I realized it was better to put fabrics together and colors together so people actually see it in the hands.
And with characters like that, how much input when you're designing that would the hair and makeup people have in that? Because again, just obviously I'm honing in on something as I said, that always stands out for me, but his hair is still as much, that's still as much part of the character as well. I mean, at what point do they get involved after seeing the look, or is it at the same time, or how does that work?
Ongoing conversation at the same time, really. I mean, we're blessed in that Peter King was in the same building and just downstairs, like his room was just underneath my room, and so he knew what was going on. And there was a thing with the hair, and Peter or someone decided to have a bird going into his hat, so there had to be bird shit coming down his hair. So that was like a conversation from early on.
Just a normal conversation. What are we going to do about the bird poo?
Yeah, where's that going? Is any going to be on the costume, and what's it made of? That was a nice Radagast.
The second he comes on stage with, I mean, the stage on screen with the rabbits pulling the sleigh and everything, it's I said it's something I remember, and I can't name you many of the characters off the top of my head like my wife would, but Radagast is one of the ones I can name just because it was memorable to me. He was memorable to me. What initially excites or draws you to a project? What makes you go, you've now started, you obviously started in The Hobbit and then things went on from there really for you as a designer. What draws you to the productions that you work on or that you design?
I think I have to have some attachment to it. I'm usually drawn by the subject matter or the script or a combination of both. So things like, well, like The Man Who Knew Infinity, to me, that was such a fascinating story, a true story about this instinctive mathematician from a tiny place in India, and what happened to him was just a really fascinating story. So that drew me, and there's a book about him, and I read it avidly, and that was what drew me to that. But then, you know, like, I've just recently completed last year a thing called The Singapore Grip, written by Christopher Hampton.
Yes.
And, well, as you know, because I started Life Angels yes. with it, but the thing about that was, as soon as I heard about it and realised that Christopher Hampton was writing the script, I was like, well, that's probably going to be good then. And then once I knew what the book was and the story, I just thought, well, that sounds really interesting to me. And it's period. I prefer period and fantasy things. I wouldn't rule out doing a James Bond movie. Someone asked me to do it. But I'm more drawn towards period and fantasy and historical things than selecting clothes from Selfridges, really, to be perfectly honest.
Singapore Grip, which obviously isn't out yet, but what we saw from the designs, what you've shown me, it looks beautiful, and that's not me saying it for anything apart from it does look gorgeous, and the costumes I have seen were beautiful.
Yeah.
How relevant is historical accuracy for you when you're designing? Is that something you try to completely obey when you're putting something together, or do you rather just use it as your designs as an homage to what it should be, but you put your twist on it?
I think with something like The Singapore Grip, which is, you know, the story's based around an actual event, the Japanese invasion of Singapore. So you've got to stick to the period with that. You can't start taking artistic license.
Mm.
But you've still got to suggest character. So I think that's pretty much, that particular production is true to period.
Mm.
But there was room for me to have some fun as well, because I had some, you know, singers and dancers to do, and I had some Chinese costumes to do, and ethnic rubber plantation costumes to do. So it was like, what appealed to me from a design point of view was not just gathering period things from your lovely store, but also realistically recreating period costumes for the principals based on research. And then just the variety and the fact it was a very different project to what I'd just done prior to that. So it was an enjoyable piece, and I hope it does well when it eventually comes out. Some of my photographs are really quite pleasing, not that I'm allowed to show anybody yet. And certainly the rushes look great. Thought the photography was really good. The set design people did a fantastic job, I thought. So I'm interested to see what that looks like. I don't know if I've answered your question now. Oh, yes. I know what the question was. So Britannia, which is also set in a period of time that not a lot is known about, i.e. the second invasion of Britain by the Romans. There, I've got a project that's period and fantasy with a large slice of artistic license. So that's quite a different approach.
And it's some fantastic characters you've created there. I mean, you know, from when you see me, it's something that I absolutely love, that TV series, and was so excited when you just gave me a glimpse of one of the drawings you'd done for the second season before it came out. And you've created a really fun world there, but it doesn't feel I know it's fancy, but it doesn't feel it feels real.
Well, I hope it does feel real. I mean, I don't think there's anything that jumps out and makes you go, well, oh, for God's sake, they wouldn't have that at that time. Because I've kind of stuck to real fabrics from the period. I mean, I sort of grounded it in, like, well, they would have had leather, they would have had linen, they would have had wool, they would have had, you know. So I've stuck to those fabrics, and also stuck to nothing that's a complicated cut. It might look like it's complicated in some cases, but it's not. I mean, sort of quite a lot of fun in season one by just giving myself a little challenge of going, well, I've got a rectangle here. What can I do with a rectangle to make an interesting frog?
Hmm.
Because they wouldn't have done complicated cutting. But, you know, and in some cases just got a load of calf skins and patchwork of frog together, but did it in a nice way, hopefully.
I think you did.
It's really a fun thing to design, frankly. And it's what I've most enjoyed designing, and still do, because before lockdown occurred, I was just on the cusp of launching myself into series three, and we shot for 9 days and then we were shut down by the pandemic. So there is more fun to come eventually. But they do give me like really interesting things that are, again, very challenging. I seem to have used that word a lot. Like season two, they wrote, I got this script and it was like, and Divis is wearing a birdcage hat. And you're like, with live birds in it. And you go, well, I'm not going to find that in a library, or I'm not going to find that in any kind of book. So you kind of have to start going, well, what does that comprise of? And then you've got to speak to the bird wrangler, and she tells you that, you know, the birds can't escape or peck out, so you have to find a fabric that resists the pecking of green finches. And then you're going into Broadwick Silks going, right, what am I going to use? And I ended up buying the most expensive bridal net in the shop, I think, to encase the finches in. So, yeah, it's very interesting. That whole project.
Definitely. And that answers my one of my questions, with which project have you most enjoyed designing? So,
because I just have such fun doing it, even though it's chaos a lot of the time. It's such a lot of fun. Got the druids. I mean, they're great.
And you got to do, it doesn't spoil it, you get to do sort of two warring factions of the druids as well in season two, and similar but slight differences as well.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. If people haven't seen it, you really should try and see Britannia, because it's a great watch from the beginning of the season. The music complements it beautifully as well.
It's so different to anything else.
It is. It definitely is, and it sounds a weird comparison. It's sort of how
A Knight's Tale
was, but no one had sort of seen a medieval sort of knight's jousting film with rock music in it. And at that time, you get the same feel with Britannia. You don't see period TV series punctuated by the music as well as Britannia.
There's a lot of humour in it as well. So it's like, it kind of like, you know, there's a gory bit and then you're sort of completely thrown in another direction with something that's really funny and irreverent.
I spoke to you before about the working the team and everything. How important for you on a job is your relationship with your supervisor and the rest of your team?
It's massively important, because basically, like, if people don't realise what a costume department consists of, your supervisor and your workroom and your on-set people and your dyers and makers and cutters are just massively important to bringing the whole thing together. So you've got to have that connection to all of them, and also be able to understand what their role is. They've got to be able to tap into your vision and help you like develop crowd looks and ensure the principles look as you require. And unless you've conveyed that to them properly, then it's never going to work as a team. And so it's hugely important that you are able to convey what you want to them, but equally they've got to run with it and do all the practical things that bring it to fruition. So if that's not working properly, you're never going to succeed, really, bringing it to the screen. You know, everything's got to be there at a certain time, as everyone knows. You know, if you didn't deliver things for when the schedule asked for it, then you'd be in deep trouble and probably never work again. And sometimes, you know, like you're on set. I mean, often the problem, particularly with Britannia, is I have a workroom and a whole team and a base, and yet I have to go on set when we're filming. Sometimes, well, you can't be in two places at once, but sometimes I have to go to the set first. You know, the lineup for that would have been done the day before, and then you have to sort of be there, establish things, line up for the following day, make sure you're all right for the rest of the week, and figure out when you can escape and go back to the workroom to get prepping and fitting the things that are coming up next. So there's some long old hours when you have to stretch yourself to make sure that the filming crew are all fine and know where they're at and what they've got to do, and that the workroom aren't lagging behind. Yeah, it's key to get that right.
And with that, how significant is it to when you're doing the productions, and how significant to that process are the costume houses that you work with?
Oh, well, God, yes. I mean, on Britannia, I don't use costume houses as much because I'm blessed with a workroom. And also now, having done three seasons, we've got quite a stock of things. So we're sort of building on it and not really renting. But when you do need to rent, like I was doing with you on the Singapore grip, it's massively important, because for one thing, you can't possibly make all that amount of things. in the time you're given. I mean, often TV things are a very small amount of prep time. And in the case of Singapore Grit, almost impossibly late casting. Mm. So if I'd not had my feet firmly planted in an office at Angels when all those characters suddenly got cast like 2 weeks before I go to Malaysia, I'd have been completely stuffed. Just about everybody was about 6'4", including some of the women. And I couldn't have done it without Angels, workroom being nearby and alterations people nearby and the massive store that you've got. And it's not just those kind of supports that you offer. It's the sort of practical side of it, just shipping things out. And we do a lot of things in our roles as costume designers, but, you know, we're not people that should also be packing it and organising the documents that you need to send it to a foreign country. Just the practicalities of going fabric shopping in London get increasingly difficult with the amount of traffic.
Yeah.
So you can't be like spending an entire day to go to Shepherd's Bush and back, which sometimes is necessary. But, you know, you've also got a system in place at Angels where the ladies there can buy things in from you or show you samples. I mean, it was invaluable on the Singapore Grip and other projects like that.
But we enjoyed working on it. It was a hard job for everyone, but it was, as I said, I can't wait to see it because I think from what I've seen, it should be a rewarding for everyone because, as I said, I think it looked beautiful.
I think they might have pulled it out of the bag, to be honest, but I don't know when it's appearing on our screens. I'm hoping maybe this autumn.
I've kept you here for a very long time, which I apologize for, but at the same time I don't, because it has been really interesting. I did want to finish with one question, which is, what single piece of advice would you give to someone who wants to become a costume designer or even wants to become a cutter, if I give you the double barrel question?
Well, it's a good moment now because I've thought about it only in terms. I suppose my answer kind of would apply to both roles, really.
Mm.
I would say just learn your craft thoroughly. And by that, I mean, if you're going to be a designer and or a cutter, you really need to, and a designer that designs things from scratch, that like I like doing, you really need to know about fabrics, what they do, how they hang. Massive knowledge of fabrics has helped me as a designer, and I've gained that through being a cutter and a maker. And then research, you just really need to not just think you can swan in and start designing without doing your research, without knowing fabrics, without, or fashion, if you're buying, you're going out buying for contemporary things, just you need to know about fashion. The more you prep and learn about all those things, the more you're likely to be better at your job. Does that make sense?
Completely, and it's great advice. It's learn your craft, do your research, learn it. That's the best way to do it. Don't just jump in. You need to have the history. You need to know. You need to have experienced things and work your way up to see how things work out and everything, and that's important. So no, that makes complete sense. And
yeah, I know that my cutting experience and the years I've spent, you know, making things for other people totally set me up to make decisions quite quickly about fabrics as a designer, which on things like Britannia I really need to do. I really need to work quickly, and you can't afford either on a budget to make mistakes. So it's invaluable to me to know all of that and have all that background. I kind of wish I hadn't spent quite so much time doing that before I dipped my toe into designing, but it's probably just as well.
Well, you're here now.
I'm here now.
And you're there now.
Not going away soon, yeah.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. That, as I said, that was amazing to hear, and again, no one's story is the same, and you have a completely different route to other people we've spoken to, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about it. So thank you so much.
I enjoyed it. I hope I didn't talk gobbledygook for much of it.
It was great. Thank you.
All right then, talk again soon.
That was my chat with Anne. I really did enjoy that conversation, and I hope if anything people get out of that, they go and see Britannia. As follow-up watching, I really think people should try and watch it because I think it looks great and it's a really enjoyable TV series.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail in the work, and you can really see the effort, not just in terms of the actual creation, but the whole process of the breaking down, the fabric treatments, and how it works seamlessly with the narrative.
It's also an interesting example of how proprietorial designers become, because I know that Anne just doesn't want to sort of, you know, isn't prepared to relinquish that one. She wants to carry on doing that, doesn't
well,
she?
Yeah, and it's her world. She's created all of those worlds, and it's she enjoys it as well. She says it's her favorite production she's worked on, and if she still enjoys it as much, why would she give it up? The other thing I enjoyed finding out from it is it's another person that we've interviewed who, it's going to sound the wrong phrasing here, but I hope you understand what I mean. She knows her worth, and the fact when she came back from The Hobbit and said she couldn't understand why she couldn't get an agent, she was determined of what she knew what her ability is and she knew what she should be doing. So I find it amazing with a lot of the designers we've been speaking to, it came out in the Jill Taylor interview as well. She knew what she wanted and she went after what she wanted, even though other people didn't recognize it at the time. And I think it's another trait of a good, strong designer. They know their ability and they know what should be happening with them, if that makes sense.
I think you're right. No, and I think it's also true to say that the great designers, the really successful designers, are people that don't actually put up with any old rubbish and any nonsense. Because another sort of hobby horse of mine is the fact that costume is very, well, of ours, is the fact that costumes are very much a poor relation. And, you know, people spending more time making sure the cameraman's happy with his equipment than the wardrobe supervisor is with their facilities, then they've got it the wrong way around. And I think those designers do have to have a very strong sense of their own worth, and they are worth a lot. Their contribution to the look of a production is, well, without the clothes, different production.
Oh, exactly. And it's one of my things of if you remove all the set, if you remove everything else and you have the costumes just standing on their own and you look at them, do they make you go, wow? A majority of 9 times out of 10, if it's a good designer, yes, they do. Doesn't matter whether it's modern day, period, or whatever, the costumes should look amazing without it. And you're right, we are sometimes seen as the poor relation, I suppose.
No, and, you know, and in the same way that designers have a sense of their own worth, the good supervisors are people that can fight tooth and nail for the right facilities and the right number of crew. And you know, some of those people can be quite sort of forceful in an acerbic way, and other people manage to do it slightly differently. But they ultimately have to get their own way, because otherwise it's going to be misery for everybody.
And what a perfect segue for me to be able to say the next interview we've got is with David Davenport. David is a supervisor that Jonathan spoke to recently.
He's a US North American supervisor, and part of the reason why I wanted to draw him into this world of, because he's got a very interesting story to tell in terms of how he came into the industry, but also his approach as a team player, along with some pretty high profile costume designers that he's been associated with for the past 20, 25 years. And he and I have had a close association through his dealings with Angels. And there's always a little bit extra piece of information that you get from David, which you perhaps don't always get from other supervisors, which sets him apart. And I think that's a lot to do with the fact that his introduction into the industry was as part of the film family of John Waters. Mm. And whoever is interested can look up John Waters and see the body of work that was created by him and his team in Baltimore in the 70s, but primarily the late 70s, 80s and 90s. And I think that it's interesting for us and our audience to get as broad a perspective on this business as we possibly can. And that means chatting with the people that we draw in.
Yeah,
I think you're right, because I don't think there's many supervisors who are like him that I've worked with. And again, not spoiling too much from the next episode, but it does just show that there are so many different ways to do a job.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And his response to the job comes from not just about what money he'll be earning and what level of power he'll have. It's to do with the project. And it will be a multi-million pound budget, whether it's, you know, Mary Poppins or Hugo Cabret, or it will be Carol, where they were literally, you know, at midnight sewing costume for the next day.
And then electrocuting it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's that he revels in the process, and the application of that process is not determined by the budget, it's determined by the nature of the project.
What struck me most forcefully about David, and I don't know him, is how thoughtful he is about the whole process. And I mean that in both senses, that he's thought about the process, but he's also thoughtful about the people around him and the production. I pulled out a few quotes: when not to ask questions, treat background artists with respect, you know, emphasis on the team, all of those things that he's constantly reiterating is, I suspect, a recipe for a very successful and happy working relationship, no matter how stressful the actual show is.
Absolutely.
Here's a small sample of Jonathan's conversation with David Davenport.
I love going into a place and meeting new people and trying to put together a team of people who are going to bring the project alive. And also, most importantly, the thing I always say to people when I meet people and I'm interviewing people is, we all are going to respect one another and we're going to have a good time. And there's no one's talking behind other people's backs. And this is a team. Outside of the costume trailer, it can be chaos. It can be chaos on the set. But we as a team, and I say this on every movie, I said it at the beginning of West Side Story to the entire group, you know, we are a team, all of us, and we have to support one another to get the job done. And I think that's for me, that's the number one thing.